This is The Fight Back, thefightback.org, reporting from the streets of the District of Columbia. I'm Pete Tucker. Tonight, we spend the hour with Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness.
President Barack Obama himself has admitted to using cocaine, admitted to using marijuana, quite a bit of it in his youth. And if he hadn't been raised in Hawaii, if he hadn't been raised in Kansas by a white mother, he had been raised in the hood. The odds are high. He would have been stopped. He would have been frisked. He would have been caught. And far from being president of the United States today, he might not even have the right to vote. He might be cycling in and out of our criminal justice system along with the rest of it.
Thursday at Howard University's Rankin Chapel, Professor Alexander delivered a lecture on the connection between her faith and her work. The New Jim Crow has received widespread acclaim for pulling back the curtain on America's prison system, which is unique in the world. Alexander writes, quote, "The United States imprisons a larger percentage of its black population than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. In Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, it is estimated that 3 out of 4 young black men, and nearly all those in the poorest neighborhoods, can expect to serve time in prison," end quote. What's more, upon release, ex-offenders or returning citizens face enormous obstacles to obtaining a job, housing, and even access to food stamps, notes Alexander. Quote, "Today it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways that it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended caste in America. We have merely redesigned it," end quote. Alexander called on citizens of conscience to help build an underground railroad for those returning home from incarceration. We now turn to Michelle Alexander's full lecture at Howard University's Rankin Chapel this week.
Thrilled to be here. It's my first time visiting Howard University, this legendary institution, a place where history has been made, a place where so many people have begun their journey. People of talent, commitment, vision have begun their journey, discovered their life's work and purpose, and in the process helped to remake our nation and our world. So thank you so much for inviting me here today. I've been asked to speak with you today about a subject that is too often ignored. I've been asked to speak about the connection between my faith and my work, my beliefs, and my career, my ethics, and my vocation. These are the types of conversations that often get pushed to the sideline. They're all too rare in a society that defines success as status, fame, or fortune. People are encouraged to believe that they've made it when they get that new car, when they get that big paycheck, when they move into the house with a two-car garage. We are encouraged to believe that success is achieving ever greater levels of recognition and reward. And I can tell you from personal experience that that view of success is very seductive. It is, after all, the American dream to have that house, that car, that job, that big paycheck. And as someone, myself, who has memories of being evicted from apartments as a child, who remembers watching the repo man drive away in my parents' car, who knows what it's like to flip on the light switch and remain in the dark because your parents couldn't afford the bill, I was seduced for a while by the American dream. And after graduating from law school and completing my clerkships, I said yes when a big fancy law firm offered me a job with a large paycheck. I was stunned to discover that in just a couple of months, I would earn more than my father could earn an entire year. And I remember as a summer associate, still a law student, working for the first time at one of these corporate law firms, getting my first pay. law firms, but I lasted only 11 months. I was constantly nagged by the sense that I wasn't actually living my life purpose. I had gone to law school because I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer and advocate. I had been inspired by so many of the social justice and civil rights heroes who had gone before me, and now here I was, working a job. My heart wasn't in it. I was cashing a big paycheck every 2 weeks, but I had this nagging sense that I wasn't actually honoring myself and that much more was required of me. I think if we're honest with ourselves, we've got to admit that Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. didn't give his life so that we could all own a nice house with a well-manicured lawn and a brand new SUV. When Sojourner Truth cried out, "Ain't I a woman?" she wasn't crying out just for herself. She wasn't dreaming dreams for just herself or dreams of material reward. I don't believe that Dr. King or Ella Baker or Sojourner Truth dreamed of the accumulation of wealth or power or status for themselves. No, they dreamed a different dream, a bigger dream, a dream that each one of us would discover our own dignity, worth, and value, and that collectively we would begin to live as a society that valued, truly valued one another. So over the years, inspired by their example, I have begun to learn to dream bigger dreams. I quit that fancy job at a law firm, even though everyone told me I was ruining my career, that I was being a fool. Even my father said to me, "The best way to help poor people is not to be one." And many people said, "Why would you turn down an opportunity like that to go work in a small plaintiff-side civil rights firm in Oakland that nobody has ever heard of? Why would you do something like that? Throw away the opportunity." But I was just beginning to learn to dream bigger dreams. And along the way, some of my greatest teachers have not been professors, academics, lawyers, people with fancy degrees or great wealth. Many of my greatest teachers have been those who society views as disposable, the throwaway. Many of them have forced me to look in the mirror at myself and stop resisting when I hear spirit whispering in my ear. Along the road, I've been tested many times, including when writing my book, The New Jim Crow. A wise woman once told me that, quote, "In life there are acts of great faith and acts of great foolishness, and sometimes it's difficult to tell the difference between the two." Well, several years ago, when I first began writing my book, I believed I was taking a leap of great faith. I believed that I was taking a leap of faith that if people of conscience, if people of faith had access to the history, to the data, the information that I now had, if they had access to all of this, they too could begin to have the same kind of awakening that I finally did, that they too would feel the fierce urgency of now, the need to build a major social movement that would end mass incarceration and break this history and cycle of caste in America. But many people told me that writing this book was sheer foolishness, including some of my closest mentors and advisors. I was told once again that I was ruining my career, that if I hoped to be taken seriously as a law professor or as an academic, I should stick to writing traditional law review articles and not marginalize myself as some kind of radical. And I must admit that after a while, I it was in progress, and word had begun to spread. I started to receive letters from people in the mail urging me to finish that book sooner rather than later so the awakening could begin. One letter began, and I quote, "You're probably thinking about quitting, as I'm sure many people are telling you not to write this book, but do it anyway. Do it for those of us who no longer have a voice." Now I see that I would have been a fool not to finish. A movement to end mass incarceration is emerging in the United States. And while my book may not have been the catalyst, it is becoming an important tool, one that would not have existed if I had not listened to spirit whispering in my ear. I believe the prayers, my own prayers, and the prayers of many others who are struggling to survive in this era of mass incarceration, are beginning to be answered. But the movement can begin, truly get underway, if we all pause and listen to spirit whispering in our ear. But my own awakening didn't happen overnight. As I describe in the introduction to my book, even after becoming a civil rights lawyer and advocate, I strenuously resisted the very claims that I make in the book. People who claimed that mass incarceration was like a new slavery or a new Jim Crow, I dismiss out of hand. I thought people who made those kinds of claims, made those kinds of comparisons, were engaging in exaggeration. In fact, I thought many of those folks were doing more harm than good to efforts to reform our criminal justice system and achieve greater racial equality in the United States. In fact, the first time I encountered the idea that our criminal justice system might be functioning more like a caste system than a system of crime prevention or control, I was rushing to catch the bus in Oakland, California, and this bright orange sign stapled to telephone pole caught my eye. And I paused for a minute and scanned the text of the flyer, and on it it said in large bold print, "The drug war is the new Jim Crow." I checked out the flyer quickly, and I saw that there was, you know, a small community group holding a meeting a few blocks away to organize to protest racial profiling, the new three strikes law in California, the expansion of the prison system, the drug war. And I remember thinking to myself, yeah, you know, the criminal justice system is racist in a lot of ways, but it doesn't help to make such absurd comparisons to Jim Crow. I mean, people think you're crazy. Then I crossed the street, hopped on the bus, headed to my new job as director of the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU in California. Now, when I joined the ACLU, I already had a significant amount of experience investigating discrimination and trying to challenge it. I had been working for that small civil rights firm in Oakland, where we had been suing Fortune 500 companies like Home Depot and public supermarkets for gender and racial discrimination. And so I understood well the ways in which racial stereotyping and bias, conscious and unconscious, can infiltrate decision making at all levels of an organization with truly disastrous consequences. So I thought to myself, I'm just going to take all the tools, strategies that I've developed as a civil rights lawyer in the employment discrimination context and apply them to criminal justice reform and work with others to root out racial bias whenever and wherever it reared ugly head. But after years of representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement in poor communities of color and attempting to assist people who had been released from prison re-enter into a society that never seemed to have much use for them in the first place, I had a series of experiences that began what I now call my awakening. I began to awaken, finally, belatedly, to a racial reality that is so obvious to me now that what seems odd in retrospect is that I have managed to be blind to it system and viewed myself as a civil rights lawyer and advocate. At the time, we had launched a major campaign against racial profiling in California. We were calling it the DWB campaign, or the Driving While Black or Brown campaign. And we had already sued the California Highway Patrol for racial profiling and their drug and addiction practices. So we were looking to sue some other law enforcement agencies in California as well, including the Oakland Police Department, possibly the San Jose Police Department. So we had created a hotline number for people to call if they believed they had been stopped or targeted by the police on the basis of race. And we created billboards and many communities of color in Oakland and elsewhere with a hotline number blazoned on it, encouraging people to call if they believed they had been stopped or searched by the police for no reason other than race. And within a few minutes of this hotline number being advertised on the evening news, we received thousands of calls. And our system crashed temporarily. We had to expand our capacity. And so I was spending my day interviewing one young black man after another who had been stopped, frisked, searched by the police, sometimes brutalized for no apparent reason other than the color of their skin. And it was late in the afternoon, and I was getting kind of tired. This young man walks in with a stack of papers about this thing. He had taken detailed notes of his encounters with the police over about a 9-month period of time in his neighborhood in Oakland. He had names, dates, witnesses, names of officers, in some cases even badge numbers, short descriptions of these stops and searches that he was experiencing in his neighborhood. And his stories were corroborated by the many other stories we heard about what was going on in his neighborhood. And he was a good-looking young man. He was charismatic. He was well-spoken. And I just thought to myself, we have finally found our dream plaintiff. You know, here's the one we've been waiting for. This is the one that the public will be able to connect with. And when he tells his story and his experience on the news, people will understand the wrong that has been done. But as we're talking, I'm more excited to ask him more questions. And then he says something that makes me pause. And I said, did you just say you're a felon, that you're a drug felon? He gets quiet and he looks down at the table and then he says, yeah, I'm a drug felon, but listen, let me tell you what happened. I was set up. I was framed by the police. The police planted drugs on me and they beat up me and my friend. And he starts telling me this long story about how he was framed by the police and the cops planted drugs on him and he was really innocent. And whole long story, I just start apologizing. I am so sorry, but we are not going to be able to represent you if you have a felony record. In fact, we had been sending forms out to people who called the hotline. And one of the questions on the form was, have you ever been convicted of a felony? We had been screening people who had felony records because we believed that we could not possibly represent someone who had a felony without inviting the law enforcement and the media to attack us, saying, well, of course, the police should be keeping an eye on him. I mean, he's a felon. And we knew we wouldn't be able to put someone with a criminal record on the stand without them being cross-examined about their prior criminal history in front of a jury and their credibility. And so we had been excluding everyone who had any kind of criminal record. I tried to explain to him, I'm sorry, it's not right, it's just the way that it is. We can't represent you if you have a felony record. And he keeps trying to explain, and I keep trying to shut him down, and then finally, he becomes enraged. And he says to me, you're no better than the police. You're no better than the police. The minute I My drug phone, what's to become of me? It says, good luck finding one young black man in my neighborhood. They haven't gotten to yet. They've gotten to us already. And with that, he snatches those papers, all of those notes, off the table, literally out of my hands, and just starts ripping them up. Tiny little pieces. Tosses them in the air. It's just snowing paper in my office, and he's walking out yelling at me, you're no better than the police. I can't believe I trusted you. Several months after that, I was doing a public access television show that was broadcast live out of his neighborhood. Yes, public access TV. We were doing a series of town hall meetings up and down the state, trying to organize people to attend a major demonstration against racial profiling at the state capitol to protest the governor's refusal to sign racial profiling legislation. So I was doing a live public access television show broadcast out of his neighborhood to try to persuade people in a couple days to get on buses and go to the state capitol to attend the demonstration. And as soon as the show ends, as soon as it goes off the air, he comes bursting into the studio carrying this dirty potted plant. And he rushes up to me and just thrusts it into my arms. He's emotional, practically on the verge of tears. He thrusts it into my arms and he says, I'm just here to tell you I'm sorry. I'm sorry for how I treated you. I'm sorry for the way I spoke to you. I shouldn't have treated you that way. He says, I see you now. I've been seeing you on TV. I see what you're doing. You're trying to fight for our people, and I shouldn't have treated you that way. I just want to say I'm sorry. He says, I would have bought you some flowers, but I still don't have any money. I snatched this pot off my grandma's front porch. And he thrusts in my arms, turns around, and takes off. He goes running out of the building. I go chasing after him. He jumps into this broke-down car that was idling waiting for him, and he takes off. Several months after that, I'm in my office, open the newspaper. What's on the front page of the newspaper? Well, the Oakland rioters police scandal is broken. Turns out that a gang of police officers, otherwise known as a drug task force, had been planting drugs on suspects, beating folks up in his neighborhood, and who's identified as one of the main officers accused of planting drugs on suspects and beating folks up? The officer he had identified to me as having planted drugs on him and beat up in his time. And it was at that moment that the light bulb finally started to go on. And I thought to myself, you know, he's right about me. I'm no better than the police. The minute he told me I was a felon, I just stopped listening. Couldn't even hear what he had to say. And I came to realize that my real crime wasn't in refusing to represent an innocent. My real crime was in refusing to allow the millions of people who we view as guilty to have their stories told, to have their voices heard, that I, in fact, was replicating the very forms of discrimination, marginalization, and exclusion that I'm supposedly fighting against. And so that began my journey of beginning to ask myself some hard questions of myself and taking a hard look at myself in the mirror as a civil rights lawyer and advocate, as a person who claims to care about the most disadvantaged, and ask myself, how am I complicit in this system? How am I myself actually part of the problem? And I began doing an enormous amount of research to try to figure out, why is it that we hadn't actually been able to find one young black man in his neighborhood that they hadn't gotten to yet? What was really going on? And I began listening more and more carefully to the stories of those cycling in and out of our criminal justice system. And what I began to learn in that process truly blew my mind. I learned that more African-American adults are under correctional control today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. My research led me to learn that the majority of working age African American men in major urban areas today now have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In the Chicago area, if you take into account prisoners, if you actually count them as people, and prisoners, of course, are excluded from poverty statistics and unemployment data, thus masking the severity of racial inequality in the United States. But if you actually count prisoners as people in the Chicago area, nearly 80% of working age African American men reportedly have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. It was reported that here in Washington, D.C., in a book called The Plague of Prisons by Ernest Drucker, it was reported that here in Washington, D.C., the lifetime expectancy for an African-American boy to serve time in prison is nearly 90%.
That's right.
These men are part of a growing under caste, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race who are relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. I state the conclusion I finally reached in the introduction to my book, where I write, what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways in which it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, and exclusion from jury service, suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it.
That's Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, speaking at Howard University on Thursday. We'll return to the lecture after this break.
Oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Oh my God. Slam, bam, I come unseen, but like gasoline. You could tell I'm in the tank, like money in the bank. I smell appealing, but I'm toxic, and send you reeling without an inkling. Keep you thinking, cause you gave cash to the feds if your school district for dead messed you up in the head. But still they saying nothing's wrong, selling fire water by outlawing the bomb. Still believing the system is working, where half of my people are still out of working. Anonymous notes left in the pockets and coats of judges and jurors from Frisco to Jersey. Threats and protests, politicians, mob debts, trumped up charges and phony arrests. Stage a lethal injection the night before the election, cause he got a donation from the prison guards union. Oh my God. Hear my mother got us living suicide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got us living genocide singing.
That's Oh My God by Spearhead. This is The Fight Back, thefightback.org, broadcasting here on We Act Radio, WPWC, 1480 AM. We now return to Professor Michelle Alexander's lecture at Howard University.
Now, as I began to have my own awakening, my passion for opening other people's eyes increased every day. I started to feel that I had a purpose that was much bigger and much deeper than I had ever suspected. assured that what I now knew would not remain a secret to others. I became obsessed with dispelling the myths that have allowed so many of us to remain blind in denial about this system as a whole. I believe everyone needed to know that, contrary to popular belief, the explosion in our prison system has not been driven by crime or crime rates. It's not true. Our prison population in the United States has quintupled, not doubled or tripled, but quintupled in just a few decades. This has not been due to crime or crime rates. Over the past 30 years, crime rates have fluctuated. They've gone up, they've gone down. Today, as bad as crime rates are in many parts of the country, crime rates are actually at historical lows. But incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have consistently soared. Most criminologists and sociologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently of one another. Incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have soared regardless of whether crime is going up or down in any given community or the nation as a whole. But yet we've been sold on the idea that the millions of black and brown people cycling in and out of our prison system is due to crime and crime rates. I wanted to dispel this myth that the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement, which birthed mass incarceration, was declared in response to the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities and the related violence. It's not true. I believed it once, but it's not true. President Ronald Reagan officially declared the current drug war in 1982 at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. He declared his drug war before, not after, crack began to ravage inner city communities and become a media sensation. President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term of war on drugs, but it was President Ronald Reagan who turned that rhetorical war into a literal one. And at the time he declared his drug war, drug crime was actually on the decline, and less than 3% of the American population even identified drug abuse or drug addiction, drugs as the nation's most pressing concern. I felt a fierce commitment to ensuring that people really understood that this drug war and Get Tough movement was motivated primarily by politics, racial politics, not the genuine concern about drug addiction or drug abuse or even the violence that was plaguing so many communities in the wake of the crack epidemic. And I also felt that having done the research and done the work, that I had to ensure that people knew that it is sheer myth that people of color use and sell illegal drugs more than whites. It's sheer myth, and it's been sold to us as a justification for a drug war that is waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color. Studies have consistently shown now for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites, or sell. Now, drug dealing happens in the hood, it certainly does, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. A white kid living in rural Kansas doesn't drive in the hood to get his marijuana or his meth or his cocaine. No, he gets it most likely from someone of his own race down the road. Drug dealing happens on college campuses. It happens in suburban white communities. It happens in communities of all colors. But those who do time for drug crime are overwhelmingly black and brown. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been one race, African American. Now, many people have told me in the course of my work that we still must wage this drug war in those poor communities of color, because that's where the violent offenders are, and that's where the drug kingpins are. What people don't realize is that federal funding in this war has flowed those state and local law enforcement agencies that boost the sheer numbers of drug arrests. It's a numbers game. Law enforcement agencies have been awarded in cash by the millions for the sheer numbers of people swept into the system for drug arrests, which helps to explain why so many police officers and law enforcement agencies go out looking for so-called low-hanging fruit, stopping, frisking, searching as many people as possible in hopes of boosting the numbers of people swept into the system. The New York Police Department reported recently that in 1 year alone, 2010, its officers stopped and frisked more than 600,000 people, nearly 90% of whom were African American and Latino. And in only 15% of those stops and frisks, was there any sort of claim that there was a suspect description or any kind of investigation to any actual crime underway? Hundreds of thousands of people stopped, frisked, searched, thrown to the ground, all in the name of a drug war and a get-tough movement that has criminalized millions of folks in our communities. The overwhelming majority of people swept into this system have not been the most violent offenders, the murderers and rapists you see in the media depicting who the offenders are. The overwhelming majority of people who are swept into the system have been predominantly nonviolent, drug-related offenses, often the very sorts of crimes that occur with roughly equal frequency in middle-class white neighborhoods and on college campuses, but go largely ignored. For example, in 2005, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for simple possession, only 1 out of 5 for sales. In the 1990s, the period of the greatest escalation of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession. A drug less harmful, less addictive than alcohol or tobacco, and at least, if not more prevalent, in middle-class white communities on college campuses as it is in the hood. But by waging this drug war almost exclusively in the hood, we've managed as a nation to create a vast new racial intercaste in an astonishingly short period of time. But above all, over the years, I have felt once again this nagging sense that part of what I must do is not simply recite the facts or the data or the history of these cycles of caste in America. Over and over again, I have heard spirit whispering again in my ear, saying, no, the greatest myth of all, the most important myth that we must dispel is the myth that some of us are not worthy of genuine care, compassion, and concern. For it is that core myth, the belief that some of us, because of the mistakes we've made, the wrong turns we have made in our life, ought not exist within our circle of concern. It is that core belief that sustained Jim Crow. And it is that core belief that has sustained every caste system that has ever existed in the United States or anywhere else in the world. So my job, I have come to learn, is not simply sharing the facts, but it's telling the truth, a deeper truth about our collective humanity, and about how so many of us who have claimed to care have looked the other way as a human rights nightmare has occurred on our watch. Many people ask me, what can I do? What can I do? Now my eyes have been opened. I see the system for what it is and the devastation and the toll and its cost, but what job should I take? What career path should I follow? What degree should I get that would best equip me to join in this work? What's the right job? What's the right line of work? broad-based, multiracial, multi-ethnic human rights movement, one that takes seriously the dignity and value of all humankind. It's not about finding the right job, the right career path that will allow you to tinker with the system, to achieve different results. No, a revolution of values must occur. And if you think something less will do, if you imagine that somehow, if we all just got the right degrees and the right jobs and the right positions, that somehow we can work and lever the power and then fix this system, consider this. If we were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, before the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement kicked off, we'd have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. 4 out of 5. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Most new prison constructions occur in predominantly white and rural communities. Many of these communities have been sold on prison construction as an answer to their economic woes. And very often, the promises that are made to these communities aren't kept. And prisons don't always turn out to be the economic boom that's been advertised. But nonetheless, those prisons across America would have to close down. Private prison companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange would be forced to watch their profits vanish. This system is not going to just fade away. It's not going to go down without a major upheaval, a fairly radical shift in our public consciousness. So what do? What jobs do we take? How do we make a contribution? Well, first we've got to begin by telling the truth, the whole truth. We've got to be willing to admit out loud that we as a nation have managed to rebirth a caste-like system in our country. And we've got to be willing to tell that truth wherever we are, no matter what job we hold. We need to tell it in our workplace, in our churches, in our schools. We need to engage in consciousness raising, large-scale consciousness raising, to dispel the myths and make the system visible once and for all. You know, the old Jim Crow system was easy to see and hard to deny. There were whites-only signs plastered everywhere. Black folks had to drink a sip of water fountain to sit in the back of the bus. But in this system, prisons are out of sight, out of mind. Those who return to their communities calling prison, their time in prison, return to racially segregated, often ghettoized communities. People who are part of the mainstream, we go their whole lives completely oblivious to the existence of this caste-like system. So we've got to dispel the myths, pull back the curtain, and make visible what we as a nation have been willing to deny. And we've got to do that no matter what job we have, no matter where we are, no matter what career we play. And we've got to do more than that. We've also got to be willing to build an underground railroad for people returning home from prison. We've got to be willing to open our churches, our schools, our community centers, our homes to people who are making a genuine break for freedom and offer them help and assistance finding jobs, knowing full well that they'll have to check that box on employment applications. And the odds are sky high, the applications going straight to the trash. We need help them find housing, knowing full well that they may be barred from public housing because of their criminal record, and that private landlords are legally authorized to discriminate against them. We need to help people just have food to survive. Especially now that in many states you can't even get food stamps if you've just once been caught with drugs. We've got to be able to provide help and support, but most of all, we've got to be willing to open our arms and to provide love. In an era where so many people who have been caught up in the system have been blamed and shamed, stigmatized, we have to say, no, I'm willing to stand with you as one. President Barack Obama himself has admitted to using cocaine, admitted to using marijuana, quite a bit of it in his youth. And if he hadn't been raised in Hawaii, he hadn't been raised in Kansas by a white mother, he had been raised in the hood. See, odds are high. He would have been stopped. He would have been frisked. He would have been caught. And far from being president of the United States today, he might not even have the right to vote. He might be cycling in and out of our criminal justice system along with the rest of it. So in building this movement, we have to end the sense that the criminals are them, not us. And acknowledge that all of us are sinners. All of us have made mistakes. And if we are going to build this movement, it has to be a movement on behalf of all of us. And in figuring out what our unique contribution can be, I think we can look to Susan Burton as an example. Susan Burton became addicted to crack cocaine when her son, her five-year-old son, was killed by the LAPD, run over by an LAPD police car speeding down the street in her neighborhood. Now, she had been a wealthy woman with a wonderful health care plan. She might have been prescribed lots of antidepressants and legal drugs to help her cope with her grief. But no, Susan did not have those advantages. She did not have a therapist. She turned to illegal drugs and became addicted to crack cocaine in the wake of her grief. And she cycled in and out of prison for 15 years. Every time she was released, after being provided no drug treatment behind bars, she landed on the streets, unable to find work, barred even from public housing, ineligible even for food stamps, and cycled back in for 15 years. And then finally, by no small blessing, she was granted the opportunity to have access to a private drug treatment program. And she got clean. And they provided help to her in finding a job. And when she got clean and got a job, she decided that she wasn't going to just work for herself. She decided that she was going to commit her life to making sure that no other woman would have to suffer what she went through. So she went down to Skid Row in Los Angeles, where the prison bus drops people off with nothing more than a cardboard box onto the street. She would go down where women were being released from the prison bus and meet them and tell them, "I'll take you home. You can come home. You have a place to sleep. You don't have to sleep on these streets. You can sleep on my sofa. You can sleep in my dining room. I'll give you food. I need you to know that you have somewhere to go." She began opening her home and allowing strangers to come into her home and sleep on her couch in her dining room on the floor. She now runs five safe homes for women in Los Angeles. And in addition to providing them with a place to sleep, she provides job training, housing assistance, and she is organizing formerly incarcerated people in a major movement to ban the box and to challenge this system of mass incarceration as a whole. So we have no excuses. It's not about having the right degree or the right job. It's about a willingness to open our hearts and make a commitment to living a meaningful life rather than simply pursuing some great career. And if we follow Susan's example, I believe that within our lifetimes, we can rise up, wake up, and bring this system of mass incarceration to an end once and for all. Let it be a labor of love. Thank you so much.
That's Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. After her talk, Alexander took questions. Yango Sawyer, a DC activist, called Alexander the Sojourner Truth and the Harriet Tubman of this mass movement against mass incarceration. And Sawyer asked Alexander about reforming the prison system versus abolishing it.
My name is Yango Sawyer, and I'm that guy at Riverside, you know, who you met, who put the piece together. That's where I'm at. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that you are the Sojourner Truth and the Harriet Tubman of this a mass movement, just a mass incarceration. You know, and I just like for the folks, I just want to show you what's happening in Washington, D.C. with your inspiration. I like for the folks who are involved in the new Jim Crow movement, involved in the fight against mass incarceration in Washington, D.C. Will you stand up, please? This is your work, so it's not just one movement, but we're one thought, you know, and I did almost 30 years in prison. The last bit that I did, I had got 21 years for allegedly selling one bag of dope to an undercover agent. So I know what you talk about when you talk about the war on drugs, but I never really understood it until I read your book. You know, you're crystal clear. And Brother Philip Jackson out of Chicago, you know, told me, he said, man, whatever you do, spread the word about Michelle Alexander, since I love you unconditionally, you know, and we're going to end the war on mass incarceration. But one question, there are some folks who believe that this system of work, that the criminal justice system, that the prison system can be reformed, but you contradict that statement. You said that it can't be reformed. Can you please explain that for us, please?
Yeah, well, obviously, we need a system of crime prevention and crime control. No doubt about that. We need that. But that's not what this system ultimately is. Not the way it functions. I believe we need an end to the war on drugs in its entirety. Over. We've spent $1 trillion waging this drug war since the beginning. $1 trillion, funds that could have been used for education, funds that could have been used for job creation, for investment in the communities that needed the most. It's not that we didn't have the money to do what was necessary in these communities. Instead, we chose to invest it in building prisons and waging a war rather than for our collective well-being. So we've got to end this drug war. We spent $1 trillion, millions of lives, families destroyed, and rates of drug addiction and drug abuse largely unchanged. So one thing we have to abandon altogether is the punitive approach to dealing with drug addiction and drug abuse, and shift to a public health model. Take the criminal justice system out of it entirely. How ought we show our care, compassion, and concern for someone struggling with drug addiction and drug abuse? Do we show it by locking them in a cage and then stripping them of their basic civil and human rights for the rest of their lives, making it impossible to find work or get housing or food? No. We ensure that people have treatment, help, and support on demand the minute they need it, no matter who they are, how wealthy they may be, or how poor they may be. But I also think we have to radically rethink our approach to criminal justice as a whole. I'm a strong supporter of restorative justice and more transformative approaches to thinking about our criminal justice system. And the truth is that if we started investing in education and job creation in a meaningful way, we wouldn't need the overwhelming majority of police and prisons that we have today, even putting aside the war on drugs. So we have to think more creatively about healing our communities as opposed to merely punishing individual offenders. And that's why I say it's not enough to simply tinker with the system. We have to acknowledge that the drug war itself has to be abandoned, and we have to rethink our entire approach to dealing with crime, the problems related to crime, poverty, and despair.
That's Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, speaking at Howard University this past week. This is The Fight Back, thefightback.org. You can find The Fight Back on Facebook and on Twitter at Fight Back Radio. And you can tune in to The Fight Back Saturday nights from 9 to 10 p.m. right here on We Act Radio, 1480 a.m. WPWC. Tonight's show was engineered by Mark Taylor. I'm Pete Tucker. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Fight Back.
God. Yeah, my mother got us living suicide, singing, oh my God. Yeah, my mother got us living genocide, singing, oh my God. Oh my God, yeah, my mother got us living suicide, singing, oh my God, oh my God. And we say, nah, 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 nah. na 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 na. And we say na 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 na. Well, politicians got lipstick on the collar. The whole media started to holler. But I don't give a damn who they screwing in private. I wanna know who they screwing in public. Robbing, cheating, stealing, white collar criminal, McDonald eating. You deserve a beating. Send your home a weeping with the fat bill for your Caribbean weekend. For just about anything they can bust us. False advertising, saying halls of justice. You telling the youth don't be so violent. And you drop bombs in every single continent. Mandatory minimum sentence. Cause he got caught with a pocket full of medicine. Do that again, another 10 up in the pen. I feel so mad, I want a peaceful revolution. Singing, oh my God. And let me hear you say, oh my God. In my mind, they got us living suicide. Singing, oh my God. In my mind, they got us living genocides. Oh my God. Say na 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 na. And we say na 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 na. Cause they're never gonna stop us, no, 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 no. Oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my.